and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue exploring the little-known bank of banks and the role it plays in international economies. Then, is the national surveillance state a permanent feature in the U.S.? And finally, what do the uprisings in Turkey mean for the country itself, the Middle East, and the West? Last week, we explored the founding of the secretive Bank of Banks and how it has influenced the global economy throughout the 20th and 21st century. We continue the conversation with Adam Labore now about his book, Tower of Basel. Let's talk about some sort of concrete examples of what this bank has actually managed to do post-World War II. You gave some concrete examples. One was in the 1960s on the London Gold Pool. What exactly happened?
One of the main things about the Bank for International Settlements is that it's a meeting place, and it's a protected meeting place where nobody has any authority there. It's extraterritorial, so the bankers feel that they can really sit and take some decisions there and have very in-depth discussions without having to be accountable to anybody. So the London Gold Pool was a means by which the different central banks just agreed a series of maneuvers to keep the price of gold at $35 an ounce. And you could say, you know, that's what was set out at Bretton Woods, which was a democratic meeting of the Allied powers. So they were just maneuvering the markets in that sense to keep the price stable. What I thought was very interesting was the bank's role behind the scenes in constructing the euro. The preparations for the euro started in the late 1940s, essentially, because you can't just slam all these currencies like the lira and the franc and the Deutschmark together. You have to, you know, stabilize them and reduce the exchange rate fluctuations and keep them in exchange rate bands and try and hold those bands. And all of this was done at the BIS in very obscure things that most people have never heard of, like the European Payments Union and the European Monetary Cooperation Fund, and the Governors Committee meetings were held there, the Committee of the Governors of the European Central Banks. And then crucially, in the late 1980s, the Delors Committee, which laid out the serious plan for European Monetary Union and the Euro, met at the BIS. It wasn't part of the BIS, but it physically met there. It was serviced by the BIS, and one of its most important members was a man called Alexandre Lamfalussy, who was the governor, the general manager of the BIS. And he's known as the father of the euro because basically he was one of the few people that understood what was needed to get this single European currency together. So the BIS has been absolutely integral to the whole euro project.
Do you think that they have done other things that has made them responsible in part for what has happened in Europe?
The bank certainly bears a measure of responsibility for the eurozone crisis because the euro was, the banks played an essential scene behind the scenes for the idea of this project that you can bring a single European currency to Europe. You know, it hosted, it ran the European Monetary Union, it ran the European Exchange, it ran the European Monetary Cooperation Fund. It's been there all the time, and Alexandre Lamfalussy is known as the father of the euro. But I'll give him credit because he did actually say that I have severe doubts about this currency because you can't have a transnational currency without transnational fiscal policy, which means that you can't have countries sharing the same currency with wildly different policies on tax and public spending and taxation, as, of course, you know, we've seen with Germany and Greece. But, you know, he was a good soldier and said, okay, if that's what the politicians want. The euro was imposed by politicians, not by the BIS, but the BIS did very much of the work so the politicians could do that.
You've also suggested that this bank has had a role in whether or not certain countries have to deal with austerity measures. They actually have an effect on countries' economies.
They have this effect through influence. They don't have power. They don't say, you have to do, Ben Bernanke or Mervyn King, you have to do this. But they're very influential. The fact that the bankers all meet there every 2 months gives them an influence. And their annual reports come out every year, and they're very dense and detailed and extremely professional, read in finance ministries and commercial banks around the world. And to give them credit, they're publicly available. Anyone can go and download them. But the bank, through the decades, has always been very careful on the side of stopping too much inflation and stopping too much lending, and leans very much towards that. It's part of the bank's heritage. You've got to say that they called out the global crisis 2 or 3 years before everybody else. They said, look, there's too much money sloshing around here and it's not being controlled and it's all going to go horribly wrong. But at the same time, you know, the counter-argument is, well, it's up to governments really to run economies. It's not really for a bank of unelected technocrats, you know, sitting there in Basel with its super layer of privileges and unaccountability to start telling countries what to do and to have austerity and to behave in a certain way. So, you know, there's a tension there.
A tension there, meaning?
You know, the tension there between, well, who are you exactly, the BIS, you know, this unaccountable, super-protected, supranational organization, to start issuing policy prescriptions to democratically elected governments?
So it isn't as if there is any kind of real power, per se. It's a different kind of influence.
Yeah, it's an influence. It's an influence. I mean, they're not issuing decisions and saying you've got to do this, but it's, you know, it's where influence shades into power by the virtue of its existence and its prestige. I mean, the other important thing about the BIS is that it hosts and is connected to extremely important parts of the new global financial architecture. Specifically, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision is hosted at the BIS. And that's the committee that says commercial banks, not central banks, must have 8% of risk-weighted assets. You know, if you're lending out $100 million, you've got to have access to $8 million in case it goes wrong to prevent bank crashes. Now, all of that's done at the bank. It's rather like the euro. The BIS didn't impose the euro and can't impose the 8% rule. But the 8% rule is everyone sticks to it, because if you're an international bank and you want to do business internationally, you must adhere to what's called the Basel criteria. And now the BIS hosts the Financial Stability Board, which coordinates the national central banks and monetary authorities and the regulatory authorities. So it's right there in the center all the time. And the fact of it being in the center, it gives it enormous prestige and influence.
And what do you see as the future of this bank?
Well, I think that they're going to have to democratize it and make it more accountable. Because this is a bank, you know, that was founded in the 1930s, really of a vanished age of deference to authority. And it just doesn't work anymore that it's so secretive and difficult to deal with. They're not very forthcoming to journalists who are asking questions about governance and how it works. And they, for example, they have a Twitter feed, but what's on the Twitter feed is mostly links to speeches of central bankers, you know, stuff that's already in the public domain. You know, they're not putting out tweets saying, you know, the central bankers met here and the broad themes of discussion were this and that and the other. So they're going to have to change that. And what I suggest in my book, you know, this is a very profitable institution. It's only got 140 customers, but it made more than $1 billion tax-free. All its profits are tax-free, and all the people that work there get tax-free salaries as well. I mean, the general manager gets around €800,000 a year tax-free. I mean, there's incredible sums of money for a public institution. And so I say that they should issue a tranche of shares to civil society somehow, set up a foundation, maybe like the Open Society Institute, and bring in, you know, young business people and bankers from around the world, give them some shares so they have a voice at the annual general meeting, distribute some of the profits to do some socially responsible philanthropic ventures. They wouldn't tell me how much money they give away, but they said most of their philanthropy is like local things in Basel, like supporting, you know, Basel initiatives. So, I mean, that's not really good enough. This is a global bank that makes a lot of money. And it makes some money out of central banks, which are public money. So we need more accountability here.
It's a fascinating history, but the subtitle kind of runs counter to your theme, the subtitle being the shadowy history of the secret bank that runs the world.
It does have a shadowy history, and it's very secretive, and it's had enormous influence behind the scenes, that, you know, through the Second World War. Since 1930, when the bank was founded, it's been enormously influential behind the scenes. I mean, the bank is the birthplace of the global technocrat. If you've ever wondered where these guys come from the IMF, from the European Central Bank, that fly into countries like Greece and tell them what to do and really have the power to raise and crash governments and raise and crash economies, this is where it started at the BIS during the 1930s. During the Second World War, the bank was the key financial channel for covert contacts between the Allies and the Nazis. In the post-war decades, it's the place where the technical work and the planning for the euro was done. Without the BIS, the euro would not exist. And nowadays, it's the prime meeting point for central bankers every 2 months, and it hosts the most important new institutions of the global financial architecture. So it has an enormous influence.
It strikes me that one of the primary influences is this continuation of a particular ideology about how the economies should work.
Since its founding, the BIS has always emphasized prudence and the need for controlling inflation. And that's partly because it's a bank of central banks. I mean, any central banker will tell you that you can't play with inflation. I mean, the anti-austerians say that we need a little bit of inflation to kind of boost the economy and get the money flowing again. And central bankers say, no, we're not having any inflation, ideally, because inflation eats away at the value of people's money. So there's always been that argument. But the bank has been very influential. You know, even the IMF now is told George Osborne, the British Chancellor, that, you know, really, you've got to stop with this austerity now. But the bank has always been on the side of austerity.
Adam Labora, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Again, the book is called Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World. You're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit against the federal government to stop its widespread surveillance that was recently revealed by the NSA contract employee. Past lawsuits have been dismissed by the courts, either on grounds that the parties didn't have standing or on grounds that the government needed to maintain secrecy over some information for national protection. Given the technological advances, will surveillance become a permanent feature of governance? Joining us now is Professor Sanford Levinson. Sanford Levinson is a professor of government and law at the University of Texas and the author of Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and Constitutional Stupidities, Constitutional Tragedies. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Sandy Levinson.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So let's start with what we're seeing with the current administration's continuation of surveillance, and really how President Obama's NSA and surveillance differs from President Bush's. What do you see as the primary difference?
I think the only honest answer to that question, even if I were more of a specialist than I in fact am, is that we don't really know, because the paradox of what Jack Balkin and I started calling about half a dozen years ago and things we're writing, the surveillance state, is secret. So you have the paradox that at one and the same time, certain members of the administration, certainly more people in Congress, are denouncing Edward Snowden as a traitor for betraying our most important secrets. At the same time, the president says that he welcomes a dialogue. But the most productive dialogue would be one in which the discussants really had a good idea of what was going on. That is, what technologies are in fact being used or are on the horizon? What is the success rate, however you measure success? And then what are some of the more obvious costs that we can imagine being linked to that? But I think that it's like discussing the future of atomic weapons without knowing there's a Manhattan Project going on. And just saying, well, I've read an article that suggests that maybe atomic energy can be used for weapons while remarkable things are going on in Los Alamos.
So the effort to declassify some of the information, I believe Senator Feinstein has
right.
moved for some of that. You're saying that that is really a prerequisite to even being able to have a
right.
reasonable discussion.
I think it's essential. And one can imagine different steps of declassification. I mean, one of the things the administration says is, well, we've told Congress, but it turns out that practically speaking, that translates into telling a relatively few members of the House or Senate Intelligence Committees, and then making available, in theory, briefings to every member of Congress. But one of the things that has become very clear is that most members of Congress don't attend the briefings, in part because it is my understanding, from what I've read, that they're forbidden to discuss what they learn even with members of their staff. So what's the point? They learn things, but they can't use them to educate the public. I think it's very illuminating that Senators Wyden and Udall, who have really led or have tried to lead with regard to the extent of surveillance that's going on, made some speeches and wrote some letters a couple of years ago saying that Americans would be shocked if they knew the level of surveillance that was going on, but they couldn't say anything more. So how do you have a serious debate? Now, you could say, well, it would be enough just to declassify it so that every member of Congress and his or her staffs, which are essential, would have access to some crucial information that would allow them to prepare even for closed hearings and then for some open hearings that would at least allow genuine congressional oversight, a genuine debate to get underway. Because most Americans are not going to spend the time to, say, to read decisions of the FISA court or to read the explanation of how this science fiction kind of high tech really works or how algorithms work. So they will rely on newspaper editorial writers, on very, very good reporters and the like to condense the information. But right now, the view of the administration, and I don't think it's significantly different from that of the Bush administration, is that all this should be kept secret. And if anything emerges to the public, then that is kind of immediately defined as a grave breach to national security, which it may or may not be. Who knows?
If the reporters that you're talking about are getting it right, one of the distinctions they have made is that the Bush administration was actually listening to conversations, while as the Obama administration says, it is not listening to conversations, just looking at which phone calls are made to which phone numbers and for how long those are made. Can we trust that? Or is that another one of these claims that we're going to find out later down the line?
The only honest answer is who knows. One of the things this rests on is your image of how gigantic national bureaucracies work. Presidents are symbolic figures, somewhat like the Wizard of Oz, in which we impute to them often superhuman qualities, either of knowledge and judgment or of weakness. So in this respect, George Bush and Barack Obama, for their respective supporters and opponents, mirror each other. But they don't know what's going on in vast reaches of the bureaucracy. I mean, think of the IRS controversy. I don't think many people who really think about it seriously believe that Barack Obama had any idea of what was going on in Cincinnati, or even, under a worst-case scenario, at higher levels of the IRS. The federal bureaucracy is 3 million people. Most of them are career people. They've seen presidents come and go. They have their own agendas very often, and they have their own administrative cultures, one of which may be, in essence, that we're above the law. And I think that would be especially likely in defense-related or intelligence-related agencies, because they view themselves as literally trying to save the country from genuine risks. And quite frankly, I've come to believe that the risk of a Boston Marathon incident is, I don't want to say it's the least thing we have to worry about, but I think that it's way down the list of the things we have to worry about given the kinds of threats to our political order and the kind of technology that's on the horizon. So they imbue themselves with the view that they're all that stands between us and catastrophe. I've written about this in other contexts, including the Constitutional Convention in 1787. When you view yourself as trying to save the country, you really don't care all that much what the law is. And that's very different from saying, are they letting their superiors, including the president, always know what's going on? And certainly the answer is no. And also, I think it's fair to say, often presidents don't want to know. I mean, one of the terms that entered into the discourse during the Reagan administration was deniability, that there are certain things the president you know, kind of has to know, but other things it's just as well as he doesn't know. So if things blow up, he can say, I didn't do it. It was some underling below who was acting without my authority.
Sandy Levinson, you and one of your co-authors, Jack Balkin, have been writing about this national surveillance state, national police state. He argued that really the national surveillance state is here to stay. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I think that it's a structural reality. People started talking after World War II about the so-called national security state, which was a reference to the fact that the United States had become implicated in a global system of alliances, military threats, and the like. And the basically isolationist vision that we had lived under from 1787 until World War II, in which we were protected by the pons against invasion, I think that that view was dominant even in the 1930s. After World War II, after the invention of nuclear weapons, after the decision to establish NATO, to view ourselves as in a struggle with the Soviet Union, much more emphasis was placed on national security. One of the realizations, particularly after September 11th, but this was happening well before that, is that the kinds of threats that face us are much less likely to include direct military attack. Armies are still not going to march into the United States. It's not even clear that our greatest threats come from other countries, because countries, unless you view them as absolutely bonkers, stark raving mad, can be deterred. I don't have any reason to think that's the case with non-state terrorist networks who can figure out very sophisticated techniques of penetration, many of them involving computers. And so I think this is here to stay, because all you simply have to say is, are there likely to be networks of people around the world who wish the United States ill? And will they put their often considerable intelligence to trying to figure out how to penetrate vulnerabilities? I think the answer is yes. And so then the question becomes, how should it be organized? With what kind of oversight? With what sorts of protections of values that we do hold dear?
Do you have a concern about what, say, George Orwell described back in his novel 1984, which essentially talked about permanent war and governments that were not behaving in a very good way with their citizens and watching their every move?
Right. Sure. I blogged last week on two remarkable columns in last Sunday's New York Times. One was by Ross Douthat, the Times conservative columnist. What he wrote about was the fact that surveillance state has now become an everyday term of description that we now find, you know, in our leading newspapers referring to the nature of the present state. But then he went on to discuss the possibility that we're turning, he quoted one person who was referring to a, quote, soft despotism, unquote, and another person who described this as drifting toward a, quote, pink police state, unquote. It's not, I personally believe, the kind of police state we think of from classic movies about Nazi Germany or Stalinist Soviet Union. It's softer. The adjoining column by Maureen Dowd quoted from George Orwell from 1984 and said that the essence of Big Brother is simply the knowledge that you're always being observed. That what most people remember about 1984 is the rat and these awful individual degradations and tortures. But I think that the most important part of 1984 was simply the creation of an atmosphere where you just felt that you had no protected zones of privacy. And I think that is the issue we have to contend with. What are the protected zones of privacy? And I think that people of my generation may have different notions of what protected zones of privacy should be. One of the things that a lot of people point out is that Google, Facebook, et cetera, already are collecting all this information from us that is more or less freely given. And you find these highly individualized advertisements. It's advertising tailored to you because some search algorithm has come to the conclusion that you would be interested in a book that I wrote.
Although some would say that it is their choice, and some people do not participate in things such as Facebook and Google+. So let's switch gears now for a moment to the ACLU, which has filed a lawsuit against the government. It's not the first time that such a lawsuit has been filed, but in the past, the court had dismissed the lawsuit on either grounds of standing or for concern of protecting government secrets, which I understand neither apply in this new lawsuit. How do you see this case evolving?
I think that the Supreme Court has behaved scandalously in this area. I mean, this is, to put it mildly, not a court committed to, quote, judicial restraint, unquote, and a modest notion of its own prerogatives. You look at some of the cases they have decided, and frankly, some of the cases they have reached out to take for no good reason, including an affirmative action case that arises at my own school, the University of Texas. With regard to interrogation and surveillance methods, the Supreme Court has behaved simply and utterly scandalously, not simply or in a sense at all necessarily by writing decisions that I disagree with on the merits. The decision just last week on DNA testing, which you can agree or disagree with, there the court spoke to the issue of can the police take DNA samples and use them for investigative purposes. And so you know what the court thinks. With regard to surveillance, there was a case earlier this year, the so-called Clapper case, brought against the Director of National Intelligence, where five members of the court, and I'll leave you to guess who the five were, said, oh, your claimed injuries are just too speculative, and we really can't hear your argument. Four justices, and I'll leave it to you to decide who the four were, said, in Justice Breyer's word, this is basically preposterous, that they more than meet any reasonable test of standing, even as measured by other cases. And so what the court is doing is, in effect, giving the administration, and now it's two administrations, a free pass and saying, we're not, even though sometimes the court presents itself as the sole legitimate interpreter of the Constitution, that nobody else has anything to say about what the Constitution means, which is a view I do not myself believe. But if you take on that role, then you ought to be willing to say what the Constitution allows. And whereas in this area, they've been shrinking violets and have resisted saying anything useful or even not useful, where you could say, I really disagree with this, and maybe we need to pass some statutes to rein in what the court will allow. And so I wish the ACLU luck. Turns out that the ACLU's private telephone carrier is Verizon.
That's right.
So, you know,
so
now
they definitely have standing.
There is no conceivable doubt that the ACLU is affected by the FISA order. So if the court doesn't at least listen to the ACLU and tell them whether their legal arguments are correct or incorrect, then I think it will be even more of a scandal than it already is.
Well, Sanford Levinson, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for being with us again.
I always enjoy it. Bye-bye.
What do the uprisings in Turkey mean for the country itself, the Middle East, and the West? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. While the protests from Turkey were born from the government's planned razing of a public park, the current litany of grievances are far more diverse, according to observers. What do the uprisings mean for Turkey, for the Middle East, and for the West? Three experts join us now. Mark Levine is a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. His books include Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, and Heavy Metal Islam, Religion, Popular Culture, and Resistance in the Middle East. Marcy Patton also joins us. She is a professor of politics at Fairfield University and has published extensively on Turkey and its politics. Asli Bali is professor of law at UCLA. She specializes in the Middle East, international law, and human rights law. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us. Mark Levine, are there aspects of Turkish history that you see as contributing to what appears to be a crisis now in Turkey?
I guess you can look at the formation of the modern Turkish state in the 19th century, you know, the increasing power of European financial interests and military interests in Turkey in the late 19th century, and then its role in World War I. But I don't think we need to go that far back. I think the roots are much more current, the roots in any meaningful sense, and they go back to this constant conflict in the last 30 years between a Kemalist military-dominated system and a growing global neoliberalism that brings in new actors. In the case of Turkey, actually helps to free up capital to allow space for new actors. Many of those actors are religious, and the way Turkey changes in the last 30 years, you do see a kind of neoliberal and religious, semi-religious lines fusing together, and that leads to this transformation, which in many ways is certainly quite positive compared to the older system, the military-dominated Republican system, and has created unprecedented space for groups that were largely marginalized. And it is true, as Erdogan's supporters have mentioned, that at least for the first part of his government in power, there were clear signs of opening on issues that used to be taboo, whether it was Armenians, whether it was the Kurds, whether it was just more economic freedom. But as their power has been consolidated, like most groups in power, the more they can consolidate the power, the more the freedoms that may have been celebrated once begin to be slowly curtailed. It is kind of like a boiling a frog slowly. And before you know it, the frog's dead. And I think that's what has really sent so many people into the streets, even though the specific issue may not have been enough to try to start such a large-scale conflict over. It's the sense that so many of the freedoms which have been advertised as being at the heart of his rule have been eroded in the last few years.
Marcy Patton, let's bring you in. You've written about this kind of construction of a Turkish identity. Can you talk about how that was constructed and how that might interact with this current political development?
I think one thing to be emphasized is the variety of the people who are engaged in the protest. On the one hand, it is possible to link what's going on to the excesses of neoliberal restructuring. But at the same time, Turkey's been experiencing this economic boom. So we have sort of a paradox to explain here. Why, if Turkey's booming, are so many people out in the streets demonstrating? And I think that ties into what Mark said, and that is people have simply become frustrated with the Erdogan government and are, for a variety of different agendas, are actually present in the protests in Gazi Park and in Taksim Square.
What are some of those agendas that you would say?
One of the agendas is the issue of urban renewal in Istanbul. The Erdogan government has been removing squatters from housing in order to clear the way to create very posh shopping malls and apartment complexes. In addition, he's announced a third bridge to go across the Bosphorus. There are two existing bridges right now. A third bridge is controversial not only because of the trees and so on that would have to be destroyed in order to construct it, but in addition, the name that's been selected for the bridge is controversial. It's a name of a sultan who was known for massacring Alevi Turks in the, I think it was the end of the 16th century. And Alevi Turks are people who are not part of the Sunni branch of Islam, but closer to the sort of Shiite branch of Islam, which we find dominated in the politics now in Syria. Another issue is a third airport. There are one very large Istanbul airport right now. Building a third airport will also add to the, you know, urban renewal, gentrification, but which pushes people out. Another reason why people are frustrated is because the government has engaged in a lot of privatizations in the time that it's been in power and stepped up the number of privatizations recently. And some of the places that have been privatized are sort of symbolic for people in terms of, you might use the term, public space. Another reason why people are protesting in the squares has to do with not liking the Turkish government's policy vis-a-vis Syria and the fact that al-Qaeda fighters and other jihadis are crossing from Turkey into Syria.
Asla Bali, now you were recently in Turkey. What did you see there? And what else do you think are the primary issues that are leading people to continue in the streets?
Sure. I was recently in Istanbul. In fact, I arrived on the day that the very early sort of incipient protest began, which was a couple of dozen people. Ultimately, over a couple of days, it built up to maybe 120 to 150 people in Gezi Park, which is the park that's in question by Taksim Square that was due to be bulldozed in order to make way for this new urban renewal project, reclamation and building of a replica of an Ottoman barracks in order to create a commercial center there. Those protests were very consistent with earlier protests that we've seen over the course of this spring, so also related to urban renewal objections in the Taksim Beyoğlu area. So, for example, a historic cafe was bulldozed and demolished in the spring, and people objected to that and protested because it had great iconic significance for the early decades of the Republic and had been a landmark from their perspective. And the response to that protest, to that demolition, was exactly what we saw at Gezi Park, which is water cannon, tear gas, pepper spray, and it successfully dispersed those who were there to protest. Then another building adjacent to the cafe that was Inci Pastanesi, so that was demolished, was also then demolished, which was an historically significant cinema, Emek Cinema, which was the founding place for the Istanbul Film Festival. It has a great significance for the cultural and social circles in Istanbul, in particular around theater, cinema, and art. There were protests. The protests were dispersed in exactly the same way again. Then there were the May Day protests in Taksim Square. Again, water cannon, tear gas, pepper spray, again successfully dispersing the crowd. So I think the calculation of the government was that here we are, May 31st, or the night of May 30th into the 31st, these sort of Occupy-style protesters have encamped in this park. They've stopped the bulldozers effectively for two consecutive days from getting at any tree. They've been joined by at least two opposition MPs. It's time to get them out, and the method to disperse them is the same that was deployed in these three previous incidents that I described, and generally is the method that's used in Turkey on the whole. But they decided to do this in a pre-dawn raid, and so they basically engaged in a raid overnight between Thursday night to Friday morning, Friday being the 31st, in which they set fire to the tents of protesters who were sleeping, attacked them with water cannon and tear gas, and also used clubs on them. Images from that particularly brutal effort to disperse sleeping protesters went viral on the social media over the course of that day, Friday. And as the word spread over social media, it was a Friday afternoon again by the time that people were getting wind of this. It's the beginning of summer, university semesters are coming to an end, et cetera, particularly university students and other environmentalists, but also civil society activists and people generally who'd been implicated in some of these earlier protests I just described started coming, streaming to the square in solidarity, first in their hundreds, then in their thousands, then in their tens of thousands. I encountered this just coming, commuting through the city. I live on the Asian side of the city, or my family does. So when I'm in Istanbul, I live on the Asian side of the city, and I was on the European side to give a talk. I was walking to the square to take the ordinary form of public transport that I would take to get home, and I was caught completely unawares. Now, why was I caught unawares? I knew perfectly well that events had been taking place at Geza Park on a relatively small scale, but what I didn't know is what had happened overnight and in the morning. And a reason I didn't know that was because there was a local media blackout on the subject, and so you had to be connected through social media to this news, and because I'd been in the midst of giving a talk and so forth, I simply hadn't received the messages that were bouncing around amongst communities of activists, intellectuals, scholars, et cetera, about what was happening. And so, like many other people, I found myself at the wrong end of tear gas and water cannon without even understanding what had begun. And that experience for the average ordinary citizen who is already sort of skeptical of some of the really radical urban renewal major construction projects around the city, the experience of just walking through an ordinary part of the city and finding the police, riot police, engaging so brutally with what was obviously unarmed, nonviolent, peaceful protesters was in and of itself politicizing. So at that point, you know, things really began to escalate, and then the rest of the trajectory is pretty well known, I think. By Saturday, you had ongoing clashes in which the riot police continued attacking the square with tear gas and water cannon, but the numbers kept growing. Eventually, the government pulled the police back away from the square, and by the end of the weekend, there were hundreds of thousands of people in Tucson Square, and that's persisted now for a couple of weeks. And I would agree with all of the things that Mark and Marcy have said to so far. I think there may be some historical context that's worth having beyond the very local context I just provided about the immediate prequel to all of this spring. I think there's the broader question of what kind of state was formed when the republic was founded, what were the cleavages on the basis of which the republic was founded, which, you know, there are two core cleavages. One of them, Marx already mentioned, secularism, the notion of secularism, which was an extremely aggressive one of the republic, which required the subordination of religion and, importantly, the subordination of religious identities to a kind of homogenizing ethno-national identity that the republic imposed on citizens. And secondly, a central ethnic cleavage between what was an invented ethnic category of Turk by the Republic and the Kurdish community, the Kurdish minority in Turkey, which became an unassimilable problem from the perspective of the Republic and has generated an ongoing conflict. Enter the AKP. It's done a number of things, again, as Mark described, that could be described as democratizing and liberalizing in the 10 years that the party has been in power, but I would describe them as accidental Democrats. And what I mean by that is that these were tactical decisions that were taken by the party because they themselves had been frozen out of the system for decades, they and their constituents, that is, people from a socially conservative, religious, political party platform, had been excluded from politics because of the first cleavage I named between the secular republic's notion of the appropriate realm of politics in the public sphere and communities that identify religiously in Turkey. So they dismantled those aspects of the political system that had frozen them out, and they sought to remove veto players from the system, and that was an incredibly important thing and salutary for Turkish political development and democratic consolidation, removal of choke points like the military or like a very specific judicial oligarchy that stood in the way of any form of liberalizing initiative. Having done that tactically, however, as they consolidated their base, and particularly after the 2011 election in which they won a near majority, so 49, I think, 0.4 or so percent of the vote, they have moved to consolidate their own position and now are much less interested in what remains to be done in terms of democratizing and liberalizing the system. In the meantime, the second cleavage has come into play, the ethnic cleavage I mentioned, that also dates to the founding of the republic. And here they've also become what I would say tactically accidental peacemakers, which is that this government, in an attempt to undertake a particular project in parliament having to do with constitutional reform, have tactically chosen to ally themselves with Kurdish parliamentarians in order to secure a supermajority in the parliament to get a constitutional draft through. And in the course of doing this, that tactical alliance has led this government, led by the prime minister, to initiate a peace process with the Kurdish community, which is great, an extremely important thing. So just as they were accidental Democrats for tactical reasons between, say, 2002 and roughly 2010. So they're currently accidental peacemakers, but nonetheless, the consequence would be a very good thing, namely peace with the Kurdish community and an end to the violent confrontation that the state has been leading against the Kurdish community for some time. Unfortunately, that happens to coincide with this moment of protest. And through no fault of the protesters, I think the peace process is very likely soon going to be a casualty of these protests. The reason for that being that the tactical alliance that the AKP had struck with the Kurdish parliamentarians is going to become much less valuable to the prime minister if the constitutional project has basically been derailed. And I think one consequence of these protests is that that project, which involved creating a centralized presidential system, is probably no longer viable. And to the extent that it's not viable, the tactical alliance is going to depreciate, and as a result, this is going to be a backburner to some extent. I think that's going to be further entrenched, that dynamic that I've just described, because the prime minister's current strategy, and this again is a time-honored strategy in the republic generally, and certainly also among his opponents, that is amongst Kemalist elites and other groups in Turkey that don't support the AKP platform, the tactic is polarization, to escalate conflict, as the prime minister appears to be doing at this moment, in order to polarize the political system and thereby consolidate his own base. So consolidate his own constituents around his position, give them an embattled sense that it's us against them, that they are themselves the victims of these protests, that the protests are protests that are giving voice to a kind of social dismissiveness of the populist base that Erdogan has built around himself. And to the extent that he pursues that policy, he's also going to need to appeal to the nationalist element in his base, making it even less likely that he's going to persist in a meaningful and substantive effort to conclude this Kurdish peace process. So I think that's an unfortunate consequence of what's happening that's no fault of the protesters, but the broader dynamic is one in which the government is deliberately driving to polarization as an electoral strategy.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about what the uprisings mean in Turkey for the country itself, for the Middle East, and for the West. Well, given all of what Asla Bali has just described for us, Mark Levine, let's bring you back in. You've compared the government to other authoritarian governments in the region. Is this background, in essence, what Asla has just described, the reason you would say so, or are there other reasons?
I think her description was quite comprehensive, and I think the point about being a tactical democracy is really the crucial thing here. And I should point out, in some ways, her description fits so many governments, including our own, which seems to be, you know, tactically democratic and uses a majoritarian system to enforce, as we see now with the NSA wiretaps and other things, you know, a lot of practices which we wouldn't imagine should follow real democratic principles. But the problem is that Turkey has been held up as a model. I think one of the other casualties of this, but perhaps a good casualty, is the idea of using Turkey as a model for the Arab world is now not really viable. It's clear that tactical democracy cannot bring real democratic change. And the problem inside Turkey is that it's becoming increasingly clear that a large share of the population sees more accurately the nature of the system, but not necessarily enough to force a real change in the system. So what you have is increasing polarization. What he's been able to do is what Mubarak wished he could do, or what Ben Ali wished he could have done, and certainly what Assad had tried to do but didn't have the power to do, and so it became even more violent. The question is, does Turkey just stay in this kind of polarization that becomes semi-violent like so many other countries? Does it move? Does this Occupy movement sort of fade away after a few more weeks the way it did in the U.S. and in Europe because not enough people are willing to really get out on the streets to push a major structural transformation in the nature of governance in Turkey that would be, you know, much more fully democratic? And let's remember, the number of journalists that are jailed in Turkey right now is among the greatest in the world. There are other examples of how the state has moved away from the democratic credentials that it might have had a few years ago. Or is the balance of power skewed enough so that this can lead to more large-scale violence, where the state then calls back on its history of much more brutal repression? And one of the things that most troubles me is what the military is thinking about all this, because, you know, the military, as both other guests pointed out to some degree, you know, has certainly lost an incredible amount of power under the current government. And they potentially stand to benefit from any kind of chaos and long-term polarization that would discredit the AKP. So I would want to know if either of my colleagues have been hearing, you know, what they've been hearing from Turkey that would give us any hints or evidence about how the military might try to play this scenario, or has the military been so wrapped in now to the new system, now that Erdogan was able to get rid of so much of the older leadership, that they don't pose a threat to him?
Well, Marcy Patton, let's bring you back in first on that question about the military. But then what I'd really like to also understand is Turkey's had a very interesting role in the region. And how does this end up manifesting a regional change as well?
I think one of the reasons why the military hasn't really commented on this is they've been under siege by the Erdogan government through court cases that have accused high figures in the military of plotting a military coup against the AKP. In addition to EU reforms that also were intended to give a greater civilianization of politics, you also have the tactical moves by the AKP to sort of undermine the position of the military. And the trials known as the Ergenekon trials, that's only one example of the ways in which the AKP has sort of trumped the military as an active figure in the political arena. In terms of the wider Middle East picture, I think here we see, as Mark indicated, some real problems for Turkey's ambitions to project itself as a model for the region, particularly as a political model for the region. If you look at the government of Egypt, for example, you have some parallelisms here between President Morsi claiming that he has an electoral mandate because he received more votes than any other political party in the election. And the same claim has been made by Erdogan, that he has a mandate from the voters because he received more votes than any other political party. But the problem here with this sort of majoritarian approach to politics is it completely ignores the other 49%, completely ignores the opinions of those who also would like to have their views represented. So in that sense, I think that Turkey does not provide a very good model. And if anything, one could see Morsi taking some lessons, for example, from Erdogan in terms of making the same kinds of claims that I have the citizens behind me because I have a majority of the votes, when in fact a majority of the citizens may be behind the leader, but there are many other people to be taken into account in the political arena. And in this respect, just to sort of circle back to what I started out with, is to mention that among the people in the crowds, you have Kurds who are participating in these demonstrations. You have workers who are participating in demonstrations. You have rival football clubs participating in the demonstrations. There's a lot of activism, but these people who are participating are far from unified. And while I agree with the point about Turkey being polarized, I also think that it's important to recognize that the demonstrations themselves are not polarizing. In other words, in the sense that those people who are participating in the demonstrations would more or less naturally be opposed to one another, and yet they're all together in resisting and expressing their frustration with the authoritarian style of the Erdogan government.
I think all three of you have looked at Turkey in terms of important reforms and actions that the country should take up to perhaps live up to its so-called model. Asla, Bali, why don't you jump in first?
Just picking up where Marcy left off, to be clear, the demonstrations, I think, do have some real optimistic potential, regardless of the direction they take, even if they were to not ultimately transform themselves into a meaningful political opposition bloc. I think democratic consolidation in Turkey requires the introduction of a different model of what democracy means than the one that the government currently exemplifies. The government says, basically, majoritarianism and proceduralism. You come to the election booth, you vote, and then you shut your mouth until the next election, and that's basically the extent of public participation in governance. The protesters are exemplifying an alternative, much more participatory, much more pluralist conception of what democracy should be, in which the public has a voice in governance throughout the political cycle, and that does have appeal for a cross-section. In fact, I think the reason that Erdogan is resorting to a polarizing politics in which he keeps giving one escalating sort of bombastic rhetorical statement after another, telling his base that they're under attack, the reason he's doing that is precisely because he's worried about the degree to which this has been cross-cutting. And in all the ways that Marcy just described, you have all kinds of unlikely bedfellows in the square protesting together in the name of that form of democracy. What's absent in Turkey is a parliamentary system that can live up to that model of democracy that's more pluralist and more participatory, because we've entered into what amounts to a dominant party period, as the AKP has basically vacuumed up the entire center-right into its giant big tent and represents the only pole of the center-right in a country that votes overwhelmingly center-right. And so it's very difficult to defeat them at the polls. And so long as they take no note of opposition or dissent when they're governing, we're going to remain in this dominant party system. And to break out of that, I think you needed something like a referendum in the street. And I think that's what we've gotten.
Mark Levine?
Yeah, I completely agree. The only question is there enough of a street there to force changes when they technically have the majority in a majoritarian system? And when polarization tends to often, at least for the time being, unless there's an economic component, you know, serious economic problems, tends to work to the advantage of those who already have power. So this could maintain them in power. I'm seeing something, and I'm trying to translate from the Turkish in my head. There's been announced that infirmaries are being made illegal around the protest area. Any medical workers who are tending to people around there can be prosecuted. So you can see how the government is ratcheting up the level of oppression, but it does go back to the point of what is a democracy supposed to do. What's happening in Turkey is no different than the U.S., where you're expected to vote for two parties, which are essentially one party on most issues, and then do nothing, and then let them rule. It's the administratization of governance, and if you try to get too involved, you'll be slapped down, which is why Occupy was brutally repressed, in some ways not much less worse than we see happening in Gezi Park. So this is a global phenomenon. It's a phenomenon of you know, governance under neoliberal systems. The thing that makes Turkey different is that right now it's on the upward end of a bubble, where as long as he can maintain a good economy and good economic growth, I don't know whether this movement, as diverse as it is and as important it is, can reach enough Turks to force the kind of changes we're all talking about. But I think that's really the most important question to be answered.
Marcy Patton.
As a comparativist, I would say I'm reminded of the citizen initiative movements in Germany in the 1970s, which produced ultimately the Green Party. And the citizen initiative movements were a reaction to the main party system, which basically excluded people, didn't consider, you know, their interests, their concerns, and it led to local level activism by citizens across Germany. And ultimately, picking up on sort of something that Asla said, these movements cross-cut the existing party system. And I think if we have any sort of optimistic perspective on this, it's that the cross-cuttingness of these movements works against polarization in Turkey and does produce, I think, the opportunity for positive change, and that positive change can coalesce despite, you know, the differences of the groups. There are issues that these people do share in common.
Well, thank you so much to the three of you, Marcy Patton, Mark Levine, and Asla Bali. Really appreciate your time, your research, and your willingness to share it with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mark Levine is a professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. His books include Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. Marcy Patton is a professor of politics at Fairfield University and has published extensively on Turkey and its politics. Asli Bali is professor of law at UCLA. She specializes in the Middle East, international law, and human rights law. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranakine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.